Chapter 9. Oxford, October 1928. Tom unfolds the letter with fingers made suddenly clumsy. He felt sure it was from her as soon as he saw the unfamiliar hand on the envelope. Green ink, beautifully shaped, calligraphic lettering, a mark of that expensive Swiss education. But a subversive quality to the style, too, a certain flamboyance that is unmistakably hers alone. He had given up hope of hearing. Over a month had passed since he saw her, and nothing. Now, miraculously, here it is. Word from Alice. If he had expected to find a long letter, he is to be disappointed. A couple of lines, merely. Dearest T, staying with Aunt Margaret in Oxfordshire. She has a car, and she's going to get her man to teach me how to drive it. Apparently there's nothing to it. Perhaps I shall come and visit. Still a few weeks left for picnics, I think. A. No date to look forward to, no confirmation that she will come. Yet this makes the possibility of it all the more thrilling. 3 days later, Tom walks outside to find that something is happening in front of the building. There is an electric hum of excitement in the air, and a cluster of students stand in the street, intent upon some spectacle as yet invisible to him. He steps through the arched entrance, and then he can see it. There, almost too large and modern to look quite real next to the antique building before it, is an enormous car. Chrome body, gleaming expensively in the autumn sunshine. In the front seat sits a woman from a Vogue illustration, a fantasy. Emerald cloche pulled low above a pale face framed by the soft, dark suggestion of her hair. Alice has come to Oxford. I thought it would be fun to look the part, she tells him, as they fly along the lanes that have led them ever deeper into the countryside outside the city. The hands that grip the lever steering wheel before her are clad in gloves of soft, close-fitting kid, and she wears a jacket of the same rich green as her hat. The same hat that, when they rounded the bend in the road from the college, she pulled off impatiently so that she could let the dark mop of her hair whip across her face. It's a bit much for picnicking, but it seemed worth it. A bit of a pantomime. Tom thinks of the surge of pride he felt, climbing in beside her before his watching peers. A feeling that had only a little to do with the spectacular car. It is unusually warm for October, though it feels odd to be picnicking on ground carpeted with dead and rotting leaves. They unpack the things they bought in a grocer's shop en route. A rustic meal, bread, a lump of wax-sealed cheese, a couple of bottles of cheap red wine. The lunch of a French peasant, Alice says delightedly. She has a smear of engine grease across her flushed cheek that Tom can't quite bring himself to point out. The best sort of meal, she declares. Who in their right mind wouldn't prefer this to one of those interminable dinners with six courses of tiny portions, all lukewarm from the fussing and stalling before they get to the table? Tom nods, although he hasn't had much in the way of that sort of dinner, in all honesty. He tends to live on sandwiches in his rooms, punctuated by the odd supper in the college dining room when he manages to get to it. This is the gulf between them, the one that she has always been so wonderfully ignorant of. They eat their lunch and lie back on the rug, full, content, warm by the wine, so that neither notices the air growing cooler or the shadows lengthening. They are both slightly to the wrong side of tipsy, and the time has come for the sort of confidences best made in this state. "Do you know," says Alice, "I always thought your sisters rather hated me."
"Oh, no, not hated. I think they didn't quite understand you. They didn't see why you wanted to get all grubby on the beach like a boy while they played clean, dull games with their dolls.
I never had much time for that sort of thing, to my mother's despair. What are they like now, your sisters?"
"Not quite so fond of dolls. My older sister,
Rosa."
"Yes, Rosa. She recently had her second child."
"Oh, how marvellous. I'm not surprised. She was always a caring type. I could see it in the way she looked after you. And
Caro?"
"Yes. She was such a beauty even then. Do you know, I think Ma would have exchanged us two if she could." Tom isn't sure this is quite true. Yes, Alice's mother did seem to feel the horror of having produced such an unfeminine child, but he doubted that Lady Eversley ever paid much attention to the Stafford children, except, perhaps, to disapprove of them as acquaintances for her own. You know, Archie was fond of Rosa, I remember.
Oh, I think she was fond of him.
He feels slightly disloyal, even now, but the wine has loosened his tongue.
I think she was rather in love with him, as much as a 14-year-old could be. She'd draw pictures of them together in her sketchbook, their marriage, their children. I found it. She was terribly cross.
Poor Rosa. But Alice's tone had lost its levity. Poor Archie. Tom nods, thinking of the war.
It must have been awful for you. He was so young.
She turns to him. Oh, you think I mean about him dying? He looks at her in surprise.
Well, yes.
I do mean that, but I was thinking of something else, too. She frowns. I wish every day that he was still here. But it would have been hard for him if he'd lived, you know.
What do you mean?
Tom asks, thinking of the affable golden person he had been so in awe of. Everything must have been easy for him. Archie Eversley had seemed to excel in anything he chose to do. Alice rolls onto a forearm. Her cheeks are rosy from the wine, two livid points of colour in her pale face, and her hair falls across her brow. He remembers her lying beside him in this way in the treehouse, sharing secrets. Tom, I know I can say this to you because I'm certain you won't speak of it to anyone else. He shakes his head.
I won't.
I know. She pauses. Do you remember that friend, Ralph, the one who came down halfway through the summer to stay with us? There was some trouble with his parents, a separation, I think. Tom nods. He recalls a slight, dark young man with a face that seemed that of a far older person, someone who had seen much, who knew things. Such an odd friend for Archie, he'd thought at the time. The two of them so different. Archie radiating energy and athleticism, whilst Ralph was watchful and withdrawn, a classic introvert. I followed them once. I was cross with Archie for always going off and leaving us. She smiles up at him. Not that I wasn't satisfied with you for company, but I didn't like the idea that Archie thought himself too good, too old, for Wynard Cove. He and Ralph were always disappearing off on their bicycles for a whole day at a time, never asking us if we'd like to come along. There was something else, too, something I couldn't work out. Tom feels a prickle of apprehension, without quite knowing why. I followed them out to the paddock and saw them go into the stables. At first I thought they were going to reappear with one of the ponies, but then I realised they'd gone into the empty stall at the end, which was being kept ready for the new mare. I waited for several minutes, and when they didn't reappear, I decided they must have made themselves a hideaway there, like the one we had in the treehouse. It was quite exciting. It became a mission of sorts. I knew that there was a window high up in the back to let a bit of light in when both doors were bolted. I climbed up to it, stealthy as I could. I remember my shoe got caught in a nick in the wood and I had to wriggle it free, but I managed it without a sound, and I was proud of myself. At first I could barely make them out, only vague shapes. I rubbed the glass until it was clearer, and there they were, embracing. Not in the way that friends might, but as I understood, a man and a woman might. And I saw them kiss. It was almost violent. I was so shocked my arms forgot to hold me up, and I fell down, my leg catching a loose nail on the way. I couldn't feel any pain, but it began to bleed almost immediately. It was that thin skin over the shin bone. Blood, quite a bit of it, running down my leg and into my sock. I ran as fast as I could for the copse behind the paddock, and I thought I had done it in time. A moment later they came out, Archie first, followed by Ralph, and I watched them from behind my tree. They looked up and down the paddock for a couple of seconds and seemed to decide it must have been nothing. Archie began to walk away, back in the direction of the house, and Ralph made as though to follow him, but then he turned suddenly and looked straight across at the tree. Even if he couldn't actually see me, he knew I was there.
When I next saw Archie at tea, he was careful around me. I was desperate for him to tease me, as he always did. Instead, he treated me like a stranger, inquiring politely about my leg, but not with the affection he normally would. He was like that, more or less, until he went away to the front.
"I'm sorry," Tom says.
"Don't be. It can't be helped. I only wish that he could have trusted me enough to understand that he didn't need to be careful, that I would never have told, that I would have kept his secret for him." Tom wakes without remembering falling asleep, to discover that the sky is beginning to lose its light. Alice lies on her side, eyes closed. Her face is close, just beneath his own. He can see the constellation of faint freckles, a surprise against her pale skin, across the bridge of her nose and cheeks. He can study the shape of her mouth, the sharp indentation above her upper lip that gives the impression that her lips, when they are not smiling, are set in a slight pout. He sighs. Alice returns 2 days later, causing a sensation once more at the gates. She wears dun riding breeches, a short tweed jacket, men's brogues. Her hat this time is a red cloche, pulled rakishly down over her forehead. They stream along country roads, strewn with fallen leaves. The fields beyond the hedgerows are hazy and golden with that peculiarly rich early autumn sunlight. They pass men bringing in the last of the harvest, who turn to gaze at them. There are engine-powered tractors now, but here the farmhands load sheaves onto a trailer harnessed to a cart horse. They stare at Tom and Alice as though they are visitors from the future. They break for tea in a nearby village. The exhilaration of the drive has left them both hungry, and they order food, a plate of ham sandwiches, a vast golden seed cake.
"So, tell me about Oxford."
In the muted light of the tea room, Alice's hair appears black as ink, and she has tucked it behind her ears. The effect is charmingly austere.
"It's all right."
She looks outraged.
"Only all right? Tom, if you knew how much I envied you, you wouldn't dare say something like that."
"I think you'd make a much better student than me. I always loved history at school, and it's interesting enough, but I can't make it mean anything. It would help if we were studying, say, recent history, rather than French revolutionaries. But the war seems to be out of bounds. More time needs to pass, perhaps, before it can be considered safe territory."
Alice nods and considers him. "So what does mean something to you?"
"Painting.
I remember that about you, you know. You had such a gift. Those maps, even the drawings you would make in the sand, the castles you'd build on the beach. Is it what you'd really want to do?" He laughs.
"In an ideal world, yes."
"Well, why don't you?"
"I don't think it's as easy as all that. For one, I don't know if I'm good enough. Besides, I'm meant to build a career. My parents have always expected it."
Alice smiles and moves her fingertips across the tablecloth, so they are touching his own. He looks down, seeing how small and clean her hand appears next to his own, where flecks of paint cling stubbornly to the skin. "I don't think it can be a shameful thing," she says, "to follow the thing you love." They fly back to Oxford along new roads. Alice accelerates, and Tom feels the engine roil and thrum beneath him. His eyes stream in the wind as though he is weeping, and perhaps he is, from sheer exhilaration. He looks over at Alice. Her dark hair is whipping in a silken mass about her head, a mad, glorious dance. She turns to him, laughing. Her cheeks are brilliant with colour, and the tip of her nose is pink. He has seen this look on her face before, he realises. He remembers a day when the two of them jumped white horses. Huge waves funneled into the cove by the wind, both of them crazed with a violent mixture of exhilaration and terror. And he recalls Alice urging him on, moving further and further out to sea, until her terrified nanny screeched at her to return to shallower waters. "So this is it," Tom thinks to himself. "This is what it is to be young. This is what people mean when they talk about the freedom and folly of youth. The reckless glamour of it,
It is the purest sort of intoxication, this flying over rough ground so that the breath is knocked out of you, whizzing through the world with such power and grace and danger. Tom sits labouring at a study of a nude woman. He has joined the College Art Society, a haphazard group run by a decadent postgraduate who wears rouge and suits of printed Chinese silk, a self-styled patron of culture. Some of those about him are intent on their work, but others talk in murmurs, make lewd comments to one another, as though this isn't an artistic endeavour but some Soho establishment. Tom feels alone and exposed. He is struggling, as perhaps many of them are, even the jokers, to protect a facade of unconcern, as though this isn't the first woman he has seen without her clothes. Tom has not had much in the way of experience with women. He was never one of those boys at school who preferred experimenting with each other to nothing at all. He had kissed 2 girls in total, which doesn't count, snatched opportunities that were nothing compared to what he feels, knows, a proper kiss could be. He glances surreptitiously at the faces around him. He is sure that he can't be the only virgin. Truth be told, it's quite difficult not to be. It isn't as though the few girls of his acquaintance would be willing to besmirch themselves in any way. Besides, as Tom's college friend Henry has pointed out on more than one occasion, English women are impossible. Henry lives with his French mother in Paris in the holidays and has, allegedly, had plenty of success. If Tom were a Frenchman, he feels there is no doubt that he would now be a lover of Casanovian experience and ability. He knows that some of his peers have made trips down to London in order to meet a more willing sort of woman there. And yet, this has never appealed to him, despite his awareness that matters are quite fairly desperate. Tom knows that he should be concerned only with his craft, thinking as a painter, not as a sex-starved young man. Surely the artists that he admires most are able to gaze upon a naked model and see form alone, to empty their minds of baser concerns. He looks at the woman prostrate before him and thinks, unwisely, of Alice. The model's limbs are compactly voluptuous and the skin is mottled, pinkish in places where touched by the warmth of the gas heater, which makes for an excellent study in skin tone. But Alice's, he thinks of the almost translucent skin of her neck and shoulders, would be luminous and pale. Her legs, much longer than the model's, would reach beyond the end of the ottoman. This woman's breasts are large, slightly pendulous, with brown, shilling-sized areolas. Alice's, he has no doubt, would be as small and as beautifully shaped as those parts of her body he is familiar with. The gentle shell curves of her earlobes, the charming slight retrousse of her nose. He'd better stop. In fact, he'd better concentrate on the task at hand. He looks at what he has so far. He can already tell it isn't going to be perfect. The proportions are not exactly right. The limbs are exaggerated. The hands a fraction too small. All the same, it has a life in it. Perhaps more than he has ever managed to instill a painting with before. This could be his greatest success to date with the medium. Oils still intimidate him. He finds them heavy, unwieldy, and it is difficult to prevent the colours from muddying one another. This time, though, they seem to have yielded to him, accepted his mastery. The flesh tones are vivid, and he has managed to capture even the faint flush to the lower belly and the tops of the thighs. The hair, too, is right, the coppery mass falling across the dimpled shoulder and full breast, as in life. The face he is finding more of a struggle, and this is what he is working on now. The model's eyes are wide and round, with irises of an uncomplicated blue. They shouldn't be difficult to depict. As eyes go, they are fairly unchallenging, devoid of any expression other than a gentle sleepiness. Why then the trouble? The problem is that the eyes Tom has painted are not the eyes of the woman before him. Where they should be round, they are almond-shaped. And they are not blue, but defiantly grey, a strange, silvery grey. The expression in them is also wrong, too animated, too bold. They are the eyes of Alice Eversley,
he has managed to paint Alice's eyes into this other woman's face. Despite the red hair, the ripe curves of the pink and white body, it is Alice who stares out at him, who drapes herself nude and languorous across his canvas. Eventually, the painting given up for the day as a bad job, he cycles back to college. The sky is darkening to purple, and the air has a crispness to it that wasn't there a week ago. It seems that the Indian summer might finally be coming to an end.